TNKR Media.
Welcome to Inspiring Entrepreneurs, our 15th season, showcasing stories from outstanding business people presented by BDO Canada. My name is Dan Delmar, along with Mike Newton of BDO. Hello, Mike.
Hey, Dan, how are you?
Excellent. How are you?
Very good, thank you.
I'm extra excited about the show today. As you know, I'm a pretty big space nerd, and I hadn't known of this company's existence. Our ace producer, Marjorie Vassin, found this amazing entrepreneur for us. Stuart Bain is the CEO of North Star Earth and Space, and they do telecoms. They do basically air traffic control for satellites up there. There's a lot of satellites, a lot of space junk, and they make sure everything is nice and sorted up there for their clients, and they send important data back down to Earth so that companies here can use it to make better decisions. Really, just a jewel of a company and an example of Canadian innovation, I think, that that is really worth highlighting.
Yeah, I've got a big favor to ask of you today, Dan. I'm going to ask you to drag me along on this one because I have a funny feeling it may be outside of my wheelhouse in terms of my understanding of space. But the business concept and the use and the sustainability and even the existential discussions that we're going to have, I think, are something I can follow. So I'm going to try and keep up with you guys, but, you know, go gentle.
Oh, I won't be able to keep up either. I mean, just that the tech involved is so beyond anything. I'm just a Star Trek fan. I mean, I don't know how things actually work up there. One thing I'm wondering about is regulation. You know, we'll dig into that. You know, what kinds of regulatory hoops do you have to go through to become a space company? The other thing I'm wondering is, can anyone hire a satellite company? Pretty much space is becoming so accessible now. A lot of companies are putting up their own satellites or renting them or buying data from those who have their own satellites up, like Stuart Bain does. So how democratized right now is space is a question that we'll ask him.
Yeah, and I think it's also very interesting. If you want to look at, you know, conquering space, there is definitely I'm sure he'll get into the discussion of, you know, working together in the community, but we also know that this is a huge run from a power battle. From, you know, some of the big countries in the world, Russia, the U.S., China, in terms of, you know, how do you conquer space and ultimately, you know, their objectives and what are they going to do with it? I mean, you can go back to the whole, you know, conquering the land that we step on today and going back thousands of years. And we all know that it may have had some moral side to why they wanted to go into other lands. But we also know that it had a very, very steep implication on the people that they either conquered or the environment with which they conquered. So, you know, I think this is going to have a little bit of history revisited here, just in an environment that most of us can't necessarily grasp.
Let's get a bit more deep here, Mike. I like the philosophy behind what you're saying. And, you know, when we talk about conquering new territories in a way on Earth, I mean, there's not a whole lot left to discover. And in terms of areas where to be a truly pioneering entrepreneur, a lot of entrepreneurs are looking up to space to be that pioneer.
Yeah, I think, you know, you've got two choices at this point. Is, you know, it's conquering underwater, which we know has already started in terms of, you know, under ocean cable and everything else. But yeah, I think the vast unknown, and I think there's multiple layers here. There's that operational layer that we would see, if you want to call it that, in terms of the debris or what's flying through where an airplane traffic control tower, you know, that type of stuff. And then you're getting into other planets, you're getting to, you know, a much deeper way. But, you know, I think a lot of what we're going to talk about today is going to fall probably closer to home than we really think in a lot of this. And, you know, the discussion of satellites, you know, I realized that at one point that, you know, these are going up on a pretty regular basis, and it's astounding how many are out there now. And I'm sure at some point our guest will quantify that for us. But you know, we like to think that there's, you know, 50 or 100 satellites floating out there, and they're all being used for good purposes. But we know that human nature is not that kind to itself.
This is one of those complicated episodes that we know we'll need more time for on the podcast. So there'll be extra material for sure from today's conversation on the podcast. And please subscribe on iHeartRadio, Apple, Spotify, and you get extra material many weeks here on the program from our fascinating guests. And speaking of complicated, because we want to just go a little bit more complicated on the show today, we're going to talk about entrepreneurs here in Canada who are needing to register for taxes, to pay taxes in the States. And our specialist from BDO will join us about that, those misconceptions and things to watch for as you pay taxes for foreign sales.
You know, I like to wager occasionally, so I'm going to put a wager in with you, Dan. Which one is going to end up being more complex by the time we finish this show today? Is it going to be, you know, space, or is it going to be U.S. tax? I think it's going to be pretty close.
Fair enough. We want to get to current events. We usually do that at this time, but once in a while, we decided we're going to do a bit of a book club and talk about some books that we've read lately or read in the recent past and how they are affecting our entrepreneurial outlook, I guess. So you got a couple nominations. Let's go. We'll do this maybe every month or two, Mike. You give me one from a recent reading and I'll do the same. Where would you like to begin?
I finished reading Going Infinite, The Rise and Fall of a New Tycoon, which is by Michael Lewis, who we know has done everything from Moneyball to a series of books based on Wall Street through the 80s. Yeah, I think he spent time at Solomon Brothers at one point. And he's kind of a fascinating read in the way he takes things. But, you know, this story of Samuel Bankman-Fried and Going Infinite is really it's Michael Lewis's story on Sam Bankman-Fried and the rise and fall. And, you know, the opening scenario of this is, you know, when Michael Lewis first met him, he says that he was the world's youngest billionaire and crypto Gatsby. And, you know, at one point throughout the book, he dabbles with the concept that Samuel Bankman-Fried may be our first trillionaire. You know, and going into those areas, and he certainly was on the, you know, Forbes billionaire list almost overnight. He was on the spectrum, highly misunderstood because, you know, part of his inability to have any kind of social cues and social skills. He was a, you know, video game junkie. Had some very interesting encounters with some employees. You know, if you happen to be running HR, Sam Bankman-Fried was clearly your nightmare waiting to happen every time he opened his mouth dealing with people. And then it fascinates me. It fascinates me in the way our world throws money at what they think is going to be the next biggest thing. And I'm going to say, they were lacking some due diligence on their part as they threw money at Sam Bankman-Fried. And, you know, he became a high-end philanthropist. He was, you know, you name it, he was doing it. And he just managed to be a perfect example of I can do no wrong. Everything is what I want it to be. There was a sense of entitlement. There was a sense of power. There was a sense that I am just better than everybody else. And it came crashing down around him. And, you know, for those of you that have followed the story, it really is a mind-bending trajectory of a character who never liked rules and, you know, was allowed to play by his own. And that to me is probably the biggest part, is just how much he was allowed to do his own thing and played by his own rules, regardless of, you know, all the things we've put into place in the markets, the stock markets, all the things we put in place in the government. There was just nothing behind the exercise. And it doesn't mean that the cryptocurrency discussion is a non-valid one, but it was the way that this game plays out. And really, it seemed at some point like it was a game to him.
I wonder what the lesson from the Sam Bankman-Fried affair is. And one that comes to mind is that no one, no matter how innovative they are perceived to be, is above due diligence.
So I'm going to take it in a different direction, Dan. I'm going to say to you that it's a stunning read in human nature, how greed will constantly prevail in one form or another while somebody tries to find the next best mousetrap or to find their way around the system. So the moralist in me likes your approach. The realist in me says, hey, you know what? This is going to happen again somewhere else.
I guess I'm not going to tell you about my Delcoin project. We'll just move on.
I'm curious, but I have a funny feeling you might follow a few more of the rules than Sam Bankman-Fried did. So, you know, I have a little more trust in you.
Okay, my recommendation is one I've brought up on the show before, but to go a bit more in depth about the coddling of the American mind. It came out a few years ago, and the reason I think that book is so important for anyone who communicates, especially and does marketing or communications, writes or gives speeches or understands the interplay between people and audiences these days. The coddling is really revelatory about our times. So it's a social psychologist, Jonathan Haidt, along with Greg Lukianoff, who's the head of the FIRE free speech organization in the States. And so they came together to basically quantify the sort of social panic and cancel culture and all that related to new media these days. So they take it back to 2012 and the beginnings there, certain campus conflicts and stuff like that, and they take it all the way up to the implementation of some policies at the corporate level and more contemporary debates. And throughout, I think you get a really an interesting sense of how our brains have been modified by our internet platforms and by social media in particular. And so those platforms are increasingly forcing us to be more desperate, to be more antisocial, to be more spectacular and sensational in our presentation. And there are inherent contradictions there. If you're in politics, for instance, or if you're in business, it creates illusions and illusions of the type that we see with Sam Bankman-Fried, to come back to your book, Mike. And this creation of the illusion in new media, I think, is one of the most important lessons for communicators in recent years. The Canadian philosopher Marshall McLuhan once described, mediums, radio as a bit of cooler medium and TV as a hot medium because you can see people and interact. And my takeaway from the coddling of the American mind is that the internet and social media is like a white hot medium. So it's not only hot and you see people and interact with people and Web 2.0, you're going back and forth, but it's not a mirror on our society. It's more of a funhouse mirror. And so it creates this really amplified, distorted, and often disturbingly negative effect on whatever content is presented. And so we work especially with professional services firms, and so the internet is especially perilous for professionals and for people who live by a code and for people who have to respect the rules. And so that was the coddling was gave me some really incredible lessons in that respect that we've implemented in a very direct way on in our business.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I get the feeling that every time we look at something, something has to one up the previous one, right? So, if you start from ground zero, the one up isn't so dramatic. The next one up after that, a little bit more. By the time you've one upped a million times, what's left to one up, and how sensationalistic do you have to be, and move away from any sense of realism and move it into a territory that because you need the shock value of things, and I think we see that in our day-to-day, business operations. How do you, shock the market? How do you shock the people around you? How do you make such an impact that at some point you can't even keep up with the impact that you've promised to make?
Indeed, often people who publish stuff can't even keep up with their own virality. So that becomes a problem as well. We'll have to do some more book club in the next few weeks, Mike. But a couple of interesting picks there. So Coddling of the American Mind for me and yours.
Going Infinite, The Rise and Fall of a New Tycoon by Michael Lewis, the story of Sam Bankman-Fried.
And Mike, let's get right to our guest. Very excited as a space geek. Let's welcome in Stuart Bain, CEO of North Star Earth and Space. Stuart, welcome to Inspiring Entrepreneurs.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
So very fascinating. It's one of these companies that we didn't know was in town, but we're excited to learn about. Tell me, what is North Star Earth and Space?
So North Star Earth and Space, a little bit like the title or the name of the organization depicts, North Star being a guiding light, a way to navigate Earth and space. Our interest is the environment in Earth, on Earth, and in space. And what we do is we develop contextualized data products from our own generated data lake to monitor in the environment. And we've started by monitoring the space environment with satellites in space. So we're the first company in the world to do that. It's really answering a very fundamental question. If you're going to start using space as a resource and you're going to occupy it, how will you manage, how will you monitor the near-Earth orbits that make up roughly 300 trillion cubic kilometers of space so that you can safely navigate, communicate, do business, commerce in that environment? And locating on Earth, we call it geolocating, but spatially locating where things are is a very important aspect of that, because as we all know, we use GPS in everything we do every day. We're going to need the same type of system in space. So we're fundamentally founded on that principle.
Mike, very cool. So we're talking about air traffic control, among other services, for space satellites.
Yeah, you're talking about being able to facilitate all of that. We wouldn't actually do the air traffic control. That would be probably a government run and regulated activity. But the knowledge of where objects are, and so to digress, not to scare anybody, but we don't actually know where anything is in space. It's all a mathematical calculation because everything's moving, because there are gravitational, solar, other atmospheric, microatmospheric effects. Things are moving and changing where they are all the time. So we make predictions of where they are. So knowledge of where things are is really what it's all about. And then using that and leveraging that to build products on top of that, like you said, air traffic control, space traffic control.
I can barely find anything in my office, never mind in space like that. So, I mean, you use the term contextualized data. Dumb it down for some of us.
Well, it's a very important aspect of what people get excited about when they talk. If you're in the space community, they talk about space 1.0, space 2.0, whatever, evolution of space industry. Raw data from a sensor is non-contextualized. I point a sensor at the Earth. I worked on RadarSat-1. I was the principal design engineer on RadarSat-1 for Cal Corporation. You point a sensor at the Earth, a radar, synthetic aperture radar, you take an image. You have to process that image so that somebody can actually look at it and say, oh, I get it. It's a picture of the Arctic Circle, or it's a picture of Shackleton's camp in Antarctica. That's a contextualized image. So when I talk about contextualized, I mean selling raw pixels or selling raw data from a sensor in space is a challenging business proposition. And it leaves it in the hands of a very small few who are either PhDs or experts in data processing to be able to figure out what's the message. Contextualize puts it in a context and helps you understand what am I looking at. And then you can take that and build on it and build tools. So we would call that an observation, would be a level one data. Level one meaning I can tell from looking at this what I'm observing. So that, and then you can build on it from there. I can calculate where it's going to be in the future. I could use it to make collision avoidance techniques, or I could use it to predict other docking and rendezvousing products. But it starts with how did I get it so that I could actually start using it, and it's a useful Lego block for somebody else to build on.
So, I mean, you mentioned some of it before, I mean, from a government perspective, but how do you bring this into a business context for yourself? I mean, is this basically capturing data and then selling the contextualized data, or are you doing something with it other than contextualizing? Like, do you have a purpose for this data that would then have a, other than the data itself, a commercialized purpose for you, for your company?
Well, I think that's a very important question. The commercial element of what we sell is the knowledge that is gained from the observations. So if you know where an object is with accuracy, and you know that it's on a certain trajectory, and you have 100 million other objects in your catalog, now you're building a map of into the future of where are all these objects going to be in 96 hours, in 192 hours, where is everything going to be? And you sell that information so that people can navigate and make good predictions on their own flight plan and their own flight validation. They can avoid objects that are coming across their orbits, or in some scenarios, you can say they don't spend their time avoiding objects because they're not getting false warnings. So it all comes back to the core of it when I say you want a very accurate prediction of where an object is. So if I may, monitoring objects in space from the ground leaves you waiting for the object to pass overhead. And the next time you see it, you may be blocked by cloud cover. It may not pass overhead. It may be in an orbit that doesn't pass over you the next time. So your revisit of that object is reduced. And with a reduced revisit, it's like you're sitting in your office right now and you look out the window and you see a car moving along the street and you take a quick look at it. And then 5 minutes later, I say, now tell me where the car is. You haven't had enough looks at it to say, I know where it's going to be. I know where its trajectory is. So when we asked the question, how do you effectively monitor objects in space in the 300 trillion cubic kilometers of near-Earth orbits, you say, well, you do it from space. So our satellites are moving around in low Earth orbit, and they're looking out and back along low Earth orbit, medium Earth orbit, where the GPS satellites are, out to geostationary orbit, into highly elliptical orbit, into cislunar, and we're simultaneously looking at all of those things. It involves Einstein's theory of relativity. He used a train as an example. How do you measure the velocity of a moving object? Velocity is speed and direction from another moving object. So from a moving train to another moving train, you have to use relativity to calculate where it's going to be. Well, we invoke that science in our calculations. And so it's not an easy process to contextualize. It's easier to do it from the ground. You wait for the object to pass over and you do a calculation. But then I'll talk about the precision, which is what it's really boiling down to. If you've got 120 plus million objects flying around in space in different directions at anywhere between 8 and 16 kilometers per second, you don't have a lot of time to get out of the way. You have zero time to get out of the way. So you want to know where it is. So we call that an error ellipsoid. An ellipsoid is just a mathematical term for a football. So the size of the location of where the object is inside the football. So with poor measurement systems or low revisit, you'll be measuring the location of an object the size of the island of Manhattan. So you'll say, I got my cell phone flying in space at 16 kilometers a second, and it's somewhere in a volume, if I rotated around its central axis, somewhere in a volume that's the size of the island of Manhattan, 13 kilometers by 5 kilometers. Well, that's not a very accurate prediction of where something is. And when you have 128 million objects, everything's running into everything all the time. So you want to get it down to meters. So that's the exercise. And that's what we bring in terms of precision and accuracy.
So we've probably gotten this down, I would say, let's be really simplistic here. Our traffic grids and everything to me are two-dimensional, really, at the end of the day, right? You're talking about now taking this to the complete third-dimensional analysis so that you've constantly predicting where everything's going. So if I look at it from an air traffic control perspective, or I look at it from even going much further into space and in objects, this is really about trying to pinpoint and identify where something is and where it will be going forward, and how then that gets used for whatever purpose somebody may need to use it for.
Exactly. That's a very good summation. Although I would add that air traffic control is a three-dimensional problem because you've got altitude and location. On the ground, it's all two-dimensional, but that's exactly it. We're building a 3D map of space. We're taking 2D images and using that to convert it into a 3D map. So it's like a reverse video game. We're taking a flat screen and turning it into a three-dimensional map.
In terms of your customers, Stuart, I'm curious, can anyone hire North Star, and who typically are your customers? What data are they looking for?
So customers are satellite operators, and the satellite operators are governments and private enterprise or publicly traded companies that run fleets of satellites that need to know where they are. They can usually tell where their own satellite is fairly well, but again, assessing risks or debris or interference or collision from other objects, they're not so good. So you're selling the products to folks who care about protecting their asset and operating their asset in a more precise way, so that, as I mentioned earlier, you're not moving the asset in space, using up fuel, which is reducing the life of the asset in space if you're using fuel to maneuver and maneuvering when you don't have to. So these folks want to know, you know, can I just stay where I am and let the object that's posing a potential threat pass by me, or do I really have to move? And so all of those folks in government and the private industry need to know where these objects are, so they're the client.
So they do essentially air traffic control for satellites and trying to determine what is up there, trying to avoid collisions and other problems, and sending data from those satellites back down to Earth for their partners. And Stuart, in terms of the new space race, and this is what's so interesting, there's a lot of there's some threats going on right now. I mean, in world politics, there are there's space debris. What are the threats and the dangers right now of those who are participating in the space community, I should say, or the space industry? What's on their radar in terms of things that could go wrong?
Just like Earth, humanity is the biggest thing we have to manage, and our own interaction with each other. Using precision data in space is hopefully a way of improving our knowledge of where we are so that we are not motivated to do the wrong thing. I'll digress quickly. We've all probably seen the first Top Gun, where Maverick flips his plane over and gets in close proximity with the enemy jet and flips him the bird and says, "I see you, I know where you are," which prompts the, I think, proper response, "Well, I guess I won't do that again." So if you're on a flight plan in space and you can get away with moving around and doing things that are going to cause problem or wreak havoc or get outside your boundaries or go outside your flight plan, if the precision of knowledge of where you are in space and where you're going increases, everyone now knows about it. And if everyone knows about it, that's what we call space situational awareness. As the situational awareness of a space, any space, a room, a bank, a city, outer space, as the situational awareness increases, the propensity to get away with doing something that's outside of the regulations or outside of your flight plan is reduced because everybody can see it. So you want precision location, precision trajectories to be able to manage that. What can go wrong? There's about 10,000 plus operating satellites right now. We're looking at getting to over 100,000 operating satellites by 2030. There's 128 million pieces of uncontrolled objects, anywhere from, you know, below 1 centimeter to the size of a city bus, flying around in space, uncontrolled. And we need to navigate around those things. They cause threats. Arthur C. Clarke said in a conference in Indonesia in 1996, Arthur C. Clarke, 2001, 2010 Space Odyssey, scientist, British scientist, and was part of development of the concept of a geostationary orbit, where we put a lot of our telecommunication satellites, said in 96, within 30 years, we're going to lose access to space. We're on a good path towards that right now.
Yeah, that one kind of left me speechless. I'm going to lighten it up just for a little. Maybe not lighten it up, but you went the Top Gun, so I'm going to go to Spider-Man. With great power comes great responsibility. So, yes. You know, when you look at it from your perspective and you look at the work that you're doing, what do you feel? I mean, obviously, there's a responsibility element here to the data that's being captured and converted, you can't answer for everybody else. You can only answer for yourself. What is the approach that you take from a responsible corporate citizen, if you will?
So North Star, as part of its technical products, as we've just described it, is producing highly precise, contextualized information services. What are we really doing? We're producing a product that enables sustainability. If you look at how many companies in the world that do that, there are very few. It's under the Sustainable Development Goals of the United Nations, Sustainable Development Goal number 9, which is you create products that help other people achieve sustainability. So with that, with, you know, great power comes great responsibility. With great power comes, you cannot do this alone, neither technologically, neither business-wise, neither sustainability without a community. So space and the sustainability of our environment in space, and don't think it's anywhere too far from what we're doing on Earth, requires a community of people to work together to be able to achieve the objective. And so you're betting on humanity. You're invoking the trust in humanity to say, we need space. We rely on space. It's a critical infrastructure and resources, a resource that we cannot afford to lose. So we're all in it together. And with that, we have a basis to cooperate. And when we have the high precision tools, we have the basis to say we can make good decisions and navigate together. The human factor is the most important in any business, and this one is no exception. The thing is, it's moving very fast. The expansion of objects in space, the expansion of the race in space is moving very quickly. But I beg to differ on the concept that it's the conquest of space or that space is there to be conquered. Space is not ours. We only have access to it as long as we respect it and take care of it. So we have to be fundamentally rooted in a philosophy that says it's a community of people that will use technology, which is an extension of our own humanity. Technology is what humanity creates to have a good life, is using that technology to embedder and empower ourselves to sustain space and make it useful for this and future generations.
It's kind of scary, though, Stuart, because we haven't done so well with Earth.
Well,
right. You know, I mean, look where we are from an Earth perspective. And what does that mean ultimately to our understanding? I mean, are we going to live and learn, or is this just one more conquest and one more human element that that we take to, take to the nth degree and to the verge of breaking?
It's a philosophical question for which I do not have an answer. But as an entrepreneur, and an engineer, I don't say the glass is half full or the glass is half empty. If it's only at the halfway mark, the spec for the glass was incorrect. So you need to have a proper specification that matches the requirements. And there's only ways to measure that in engineering terms. And that's what I'm doing. That's what we're doing with Northstar, is creating those tools. In the end of the day, philosophically, I always take the approach as an entrepreneur: in every threat, there is opportunity. And so there's an opportunity here, philosophically, for us to look at this threat of what's going on in the environment with global warming, with congestion in space, and say there's an opportunity here for us to rise to the occasion and do the right thing. And it doesn't happen with one individual. It happens with a community. And so it must be a movement. It must be a revolution of people, young people, that want to see a better environment, a better space. So if we give them the tools, if we provide them with tools, then there will be opportunity for the right thing to happen. We can only create those environments of opportunity and hope for the best and encourage the best behaviors. That's all we've got. That's how tenuous our existence is on this planet.
We're almost out of time, but I will keep Stuart just a couple minutes longer for the podcast edition, because we have a few more questions about the product. But I want to get to you, Stuart, and the personality behind the product. So you've been working in aerospace for a while. How did you get into the space business? How does one get into the space business if they're interested?
Well, if you want to do anything, you just do it. you don't think about it. You just do it. I knew when I was 14 years old that I wanted to study engineering. And I knew when I was a kid that I was fascinated by space, because I'm old enough to say I watched Neil Armstrong walk down the ladder, and I watched the Apollo 13 mission recover from a near tragic experience. And so I learned from those lessons. You know, when they asked Neil Armstrong and Michael C. Collins and Buzz Aldrin, so what was it like to walk on the moon? And everybody gets all excited, and the wonderful answer comes back: the mission went according to the parameters. That's for me, that's like whipped cream on and cherries. I mean, when a guy talks like that about something that's that monumental, he's got his act together. So he's clearly, those people were clearly understanding what they wanted to try to achieve. And it's that type of focus with the skills that they had, combined with their dedication and nerves of steel, which is, you know, inspiring to me. So, you know, I'm somebody who always believes that you got to trust your instincts. You have to have a basic philosophy. Your company has to have a basic philosophy. So if you look at the social media giants getting hauled out in front of Congress and asked about why their businesses are causing or wreaking so much havoc, for me, I just look across the board and say, so what's the fundamental philosophy of each one of your businesses in terms of what it is trying to achieve and accomplish? if you don't have a core philosophy, which ours is, how do I improve sustainability and how do I monitor the environment of space with accuracy and precision so that I can make it better and create a community? That's my philosophy. Then so you can subscribe to that. Things can go wrong. Things can get in the way. Challenges will happen, but you have an anchor. So that's important. And because you're going to go into the chaos. And as an entrepreneur, you're going to go into chaos because you like it. Because inside chaos is where all the threats and all the crazy things are. And then out of that, you pull out, as we do with our product, a contextualized meaning that you can give us to the organization as a mission to go forward. So you really want to create that sense of resolve and courage to go in there and then come out with something that's useful. And you have basic principles. You're, you know, be grateful and always be grateful for what you've got and persevere. Perseverance is the biggest attribute to any successful entrepreneur, the ability to be flexible, the ability to build that sense of community and create and be part of a circular economy. It's not about winning and losing. It takes all of us to win. It's not winner takes all. And that is what we're seeing in space. There's a lot of winner take all attitudes in terms of individuals. It's not. It's going to take all of us to win in space. And I think we need to make that a revolutionary statement, starting in Montreal and going to the rest of the world. It takes all of us to make this work, to speak to our own concerns about our own ability to do this. But we shouldn't doubt ourselves. We want things to be good in space. So my entrepreneurship leadership wants to draw that out of people and wants to give them a way where they can draw it out, having a job at North Star or doing something to contribute to what North Star is doing or using our tools for the right reasons. That's a change of attitude. So the next generation always sees the generation before as something they don't understand. So good for them. Figure out how you're going to take what we've got and make it better.
Okay, let's just do a couple more minutes for the podcast now with Stuart. We were so fascinated about the product, Stuart. We barely even got to the people in the organization. But what type of workers are you looking for? What type of qualities are needed in a person who wants to work with space, in space, not in space, but with space, I guess, technology?
What we find is people are attracted to work for North Star from the inside of fulfillment. They feel that our mission and what we're trying to do is fulfilling. I think that money is not necessarily a motivator. It's a demotivator, and that people are looking for meaningful work. So in that overarching principle of meaningful work, we have astrophysicists, orbit dynamicists, engineers, computer scientists, computer systems engineers, systems engineers, satellite designers, administrators, legal people, office managers, HR experts, financial experts, all working as best as we can as a team to create our product. And it's that diversity, as my natural background tends to look for, the dynamic between an astrophysicist working with a computer programmer and getting along with each other is not an easy proposition, because they don't have the same references or necessarily styles or ways of solving problems. But when you put them together, if you can make that work, now you've created a new product, if you like, not physical. It leads to a physical product, but the product of the combination of those two skills makes for a new opportunity to create what North Star creates. So it's the combination of all those skill sets that we have that I think makes us very, very exciting.
You know, initially you would think that this your organization would be one pulling from a very specific group of university post-grad individuals, but listening to you talk, I mean, you're talking on a pretty vast array of potential employees with the organization that don't have to be, you know, like the old joke of, you know, nuclear physicists at the end of the day, right? I mean, at the end of the day here, you're talking about some pretty new, potentially, you know, not highly, highly educated, but have a passion and a drive and a desire to work within your environment.
Yeah, if you only stock the shelves with one approach or one way of thinking, you're going to get stuck if your ultimate goal is to revolutionize the way we're going to sustain the environment in space. You have to embrace a community of diversity, and with it comes all the challenges of that diversity. And so therein, you've created your own chaos, out of which you're going to try and create a team and have them all pulling in the same direction. So you act locally, and you had try to have a global impact through that. So that is a very important element. Again, not losing sight of the human factor, the fact that it is a human influence that we want to have, whether the human is somebody who's at the head of NASA or someone who's the head of the SES global satellite fleet, or somebody who's walking the streets. I mean, you go back to the beautiful story of John F. Kennedy when he visited NASA and he met the janitor and he says, "What do you do here?" And he said, "I'm putting a man on the moon." When everybody knows what their purpose is, then life is a lot more pleasant. I think giving that purpose to people is really missing a lot these days. And I miss that because I grew up with that.
I find it very interesting because I think you take a whole new angle here to the what we've traditionally known as diversity. You know, when you're talking about this, you're talking about diversity from an education and an understanding perspective and a mindset or a philosophical approach, which is very different, I guess, than what has become the mainstream term for diversity.
Yeah, I start with the basic building blocks of cognitive behavior. I mean, what motivates us? Feelings, thinking, interaction with others, and how do we manage that for ourselves, and then in terms of how we interact with others. If we don't keep that in mind, we get separated from ourselves, I think, in terms of our own humanity. And the more human we become, the less likely we are to maybe disagree on what we believe is our ultimate goal and philosophy. We all want to protect space. I don't care what country you come from. We all want to protect space. We all want space to be there for the future. And so we need to reestablish those ties with ourselves and with others through that aspect of cognitive behavior and humanity. I think it's a fundamental issue. So, I think of myself as somebody who's trying to start a social revolution. And embracing the fact that the generation that's coming up behind me does not understand my generation. And I'm like, that's a good thing. So if you don't understand me, that means I got to explain it to you. And if I, as Einstein said, if you can't explain it, that means you don't understand it. So we really have to be self-aware and self-reflective on what is the philosophy of my generation X compared to the generation that's coming up now. And then we're making linkages. Then we're passing, to get emotional. We're passing the baton from failing hands. We're passing the torch from failing hands, like it says in the dressing room of the Montreal Canadiens. That's what we do. We pass the torch. And I'm very emotional about that because I'm a huge hockey fan, born and raised in Montreal. So I bleed red, white, and blue.
One last question. I don't want to keep you too long. I'm sure you're very busy, Stuart. But one thing that you mentioned that I think is interesting in terms of how a regulator might develop one day is that space is really busy and it's getting packed up there. Can anyone put up a satellite? Are there rules regarding putting up satellites? Do we need an international regulator? And is that even a realistic option?
You have a very loaded question there that it deserves a whole series. But the short answer is there are rules. There is the Space Treaty, the United Nations Space Treaty of 1967, which is as old as it sounds, that says do good things in space and protect it and be good. It's not enough. There are rules that you have to comply with to get a license to launch a satellite into space. They don't necessarily cover the challenges that we're facing right now. You have the International Telecommunications Union, the ITU, that looks at frequency allocation. And when if it's a bit of a stretch, at the end, we communicate through frequencies from space. So allocating the frequency and how you get a license to allocate that frequency is a very influential component. So they have an influence. And then you have the United Nations Office of Outer Space Affairs based in Vienna. And you have COPIUS, which is also an extension of the United Nations Office of Outer Space Affairs. There's a lot of regulatory bodies, and what we have to do is agree on what rules we want to set for the road for ourselves, and that is an international challenge. So there it is. There's a lot more to be said on that, but there are bodies, there are approaches that are being taken, and every country tends to have a different idea about how it wants to regulate itself. And you can imagine, based on their own, what you know about them, your geopolitical knowledge of those countries, they'll all have a different approach on how to regulate.
Maybe it'd be easier if we just came together and went with the Starfleet model.
That's what I was thinking. Where is Captain Kirk when you need him?
Stuart, thanks so much. Such a fun conversation.
Okay. Thanks, guys. Have a great day.
We're joined by Stuart Bain, the CEO of North Star Earth and Space. We'll have his one piece of advice for inspiring entrepreneurs and space entrepreneurs in a few minutes. But first, let's check in with our BDO tax specialist. Corinne T is U.S. tax partner at BDO Canada. Welcome, Corinne.
Thank you for having me.
And Mike, today we're talking about misconceptions on sales tax for those from outside Canada.
So, you know, after that last piece with Stuart, my first question is, you know, sales tax for foreigners. Do we go into the extraterrestrial discussion here on sales tax, or what are we talking about, Eric Kareen? Anyways, let's take this and look at one of the misconceptions that, you know, Wayfair does not apply to my inbound transactions because my country has a tax treaty. So, you know, give us something on that. I mean, everybody has this sense of what sales tax looks like. Everybody has an impression of why they shouldn't have to pay it. So give us a little bit here.
Yes, thank you, Michael. So there is, I feel, this general misconception that Canadian businesses that do not have a significant U.S. footprint, but they sell into the U.S. market, that they don't have any U.S. tax filing obligation. And that could be farther from the truth, because the fact of the matter is that they might have filing obligation. And there's multiple layers of U.S. tax implication for these Canadian businesses. So while some state may recognize the treaty protection for income tax purposes, those protections are not extended for U.S. sales tax purposes. However, what I see more and more and more is that there's more awareness from Canadian businesses of their U.S. tax exposure, more specifically on the U.S. sales tax forefront. But there is this fear acting on it and mitigating it, because Canadian businesses are afraid that if they act on it, they will open the Pandora box of U.S. tax filing obligations. And that's where BDO comes into play and assist them and help them weather the storms of these complex U.S. tax filing obligations. So, you know, the sales tax exposure came into play with the Wayfair court case that no longer protect Canadian businesses by the physical presence safe harbor that was put into play with the Quills court case. So now, as a result of the Wayfair court case, Canadian businesses could potentially be subject to collecting and remitting the sales tax on their sales meet to us customers if they reach a certain threshold of sales, which is 100,000 or 200 separate transactions. And this threshold varies from state to state. And that exposure is significant for Canadian businesses.
Wow, there was a lot there. There's no doubt that this is a very complex environment. And, you know, I think a lot of people like to fall under the realm of, well, my sales are exempt because they're resold or they're used in an exempt manner. And I'm not sure if that's because they honestly believe that or they just don't want to file. So, you know, tell us a little bit about this exempt thought process that a lot of people like to hide behind.
So a lot of Canadian companies think that because they're selling to distributors that these transactions are exempt from sales tax. And this is partly true because they are exempt, but in order for them to be exempt, the seller, the Canadian business, needs to obtain proper documentation to support that that transaction is exempt from sales tax from the buyer, and that generally is an exemption certificate or resale certificate. So this is the more mission portion that a lot of Canadian businesses are missing. And in the event of audit, if they don't have that proper documentation, that resale certificate, the auditor will treat that transaction as taxable and subject to sales tax, and they will be exposed to that uncollected sales tax. So very important to have that sales tax, and the sales tax resale certificate needs to be obtained for every client in the U.S. and in every state they do business, and it needs to be collected on an annual basis.
The exemption form needs to be collected from every one of your customers from every state on an annual basis. Sounds like a full-time job.
Yes, and it could be included in the procedures of the corporation. Each time they have appeal, they require that they obtain a resale certificate, because the exposure lies within the vendor. So if you don't have that documentation, the liability still remains with the seller.
I think another misconception is, since I don't file with a state or I don't file with local tax authorities in the U.S., they won't find me.
So there was a lot of controversy surrounding the Wafer Corp state, and specifically the enforceability of that sales tax. So that's why a lot of people are thinking they won't come and get me. There is a significant difference between the legal liability of the sales tax once you reach that threshold and the enforceability of that liability, enforcing compliance for the taxpayer. So there is this clear legal responsibility for the remote seller, the Canadian business selling into the U.S., to collect and remit sales tax should they have created nexus, economic nexus in the state. And if they do not collect, there is this legal liability of the uncollected sales tax. And that has ramification in the financial statements. It could potentially also affect when the business is sold, because the tax liability of the sales tax will remain and will remain with the acquirer, that it be a share transaction or an asset transaction. So the liability follows the assets. So and lastly, another point that is important is that the sales tax in the U.S. pierces the corporate veil, in the sense that the officers of the company could be personally liable for the uncollected sales tax. So those are all aspects that needs to be kind of put in a box and kind of looked into, because down the road, that exposure, if you keep your head under the sand, could really rear up its ugly head in the event of a transaction.
Dan, I thought Stewart's discussion of space was complex. Oh my God. Please save me, Dan.
Well, I like the head in the sand comment. Indeed, I think a lot of entrepreneurs would just rather leave their head in the sand than deal with a lot of what you're talking about, Corinne.
Yes, I know. Usually when I have this conversation with them, I'm not their favorite person.
Do you get a lot of glazed over looks from people as you start to express this? Okay. All right.
Glazed over look and very shocked and very... Disbelief as well.
Not to mention all the various states and the local particularities. And yeah, it can get complicated. So Corinne T, glad you're here and glad you're there to support our entrepreneurs, U.S. tax partner at BDO Canada. Thanks, Corinne.
Thank you for having me.
As we come to the end of our show, let's turn to our entrepreneur, Stewart Bain, CEO of North Star Earth and Space, and ask him for his one piece of advice for inspiring entrepreneurs. Stewart.
So for me, the anchor of everything is self-awareness and working on your own self-awareness so that you can ultimately trust your instincts. As an entrepreneur, there is no script. There is no plan. You go into the chaos and you come out with some kind of plan and some kind of solution for every problem that comes up. Like the etymology of the word entrepreneur, prendre. You take control of the situation and you use your instincts to write the script. You must trust and have confidence in what you believe and what you trust. And so I would encourage all young entrepreneurs to work and develop that with their own mentors or whatever they do in their day-to-day lives to work and develop their trust for their instincts.
Stuart Bain, thank you so much. And Mike, just another example of a hidden gem here in Montreal. We should be talking about companies like North Star more. And wow, we're really entering the space race. It's exciting.
The term wow is definitely it. And I'm not sure if I'm more impressed with everything that Stuart put forward or the fact that I actually followed what he put forward. So one of those two things, either way, I think it's pretty impressive all around. But yeah, this was a phenomenal story. And, you know, it's this whole question of existentialism and where we're going and you know, what is the purpose? And, you know, you can take it as a space discussion or you can take it as a human dialogue. And, you know, it's fascinating. Thank you so much, Stuart.
It's my pleasure. I look forward to it. And good luck with your show. Thanks a lot for having me on.
And don't forget, for our podcast audience, Stuart will hang around for a couple more questions about space and his business and people and culture as well, which we didn't get to in this fascinating conversation. Next week on the program, Fauve Doucet joins us. She's the president and CEO of a collaborative economy app that allows you to borrow what you need from your neighbors. A reminder that you can subscribe to Inspiring Entrepreneurs as a podcast on iHeartRadio, Apple, or your favorite platform. And Mike, thanks. We'll see you next week. Live long and prosper.
Thanks, Dan.
Production of TNKR Media. Good talk.